This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Sean Tubbs. There are two ways to change the Constitution, according to Article 5. First, Congress can propose amendments, which would then have to be ratified by two-thirds of state legislatures. That's been done 27 times since 1787. But there's also a provision for there to be a constitutional convention, something that could be done if two-thirds of state legislatures call for one. So far, that's not been done. But Larry Sabatow's new book is perhaps the beginning of a call for one. Larry Sabatow is the director of the UVA Center for Politics, and A More Perfect Constitution lays out 23 ideas to reform the Constitution, which Sabatow says was never intended to stay static. Sabatow recently appeared at the UVA bookstore to talk about the work, which dates back to his teaching days at Oxford.
I was teaching. It was my first teaching gig at Oxford, and I had some incredibly bright British students. So bright that you couldn't tell whether they did any work. It was a real problem. They managed to fool you. Very glib. But they would tend to take over the tutorials. You know, their system is tutorial. It's a wonderful way of teaching if you can afford it. We can't. They can, at least at Oxbridge. But they used to take over the tutorials, partly to keep me from finding out what they hadn't done. And they would ask incredibly good questions about the American system. And the questions were very penetrating, they were very critical. They already had seen some things that I hadn't seen growing up in the United States about how our system worked and how it didn't. They compared it to, naturally, their parliamentary system, not that that's always been successful either. And they were inclined toward theirs, and just to irritate them, I used to substitute for USA, I substituted GCE, greatest country on earth. Used to drive them crazy. When I did that, we had some fun going back and forth. But they would ask me about how the parts fit together. The parts fit together well in some cases and poorly in others, in terms of the American system and the separation of powers and how the branches were working together. And of course, throughout American history, at some points things have worked well, and at other points they have worked very poorly. So it always depends on the circumstances of the time, and that's a given. But I began to think about it, and I started to think about not so much the individual institutions that I was teaching, and you'd teach week by week and cover the U.S. system during a term there, much as you do during a semester here, but you would rarely cover the interconnections. And I started to think, because of their questions, about the interconnections. And it's one reason why I tell people teaching is a two-way street. You learn as much from your students as they learn from you, if you're my kind of academic anyway. Some other academics who are brighter and better, of course, do much more of the educating, perhaps, than I do. But I learned from my students. And I listened to what those British students had to say, and I knew that I didn't know enough to write the book. But I was hoping one day to know enough to write the book. I finally gave up and wrote it without knowing enough to write the book. But at some point, and being 55, I didn't want to take any chances. So I decided to go ahead and take a stab at it. I spent about 4 years off and on working on this particular manuscript. And I'm very proud of it because it's very provocative. Now, I'll tell you the two layers of thinking involved in this book, which calls for 23 major changes to the Constitution and a new constitutional convention. Constitutional convention tomorrow? No. Constitutional convention next year? Get real. It's at least a generation away. I probably won't live to see it. I can guarantee Linda, my friend Linda, will, but I won't. I won't make it. Linda Burkett is the mainstay of the University of Virginia. Anybody who doesn't know her has no clue what's really going on. And some other people in here that I see. But the point is this. I felt this was an opportunity to outline some possible changes, some of which may work well, others of which may not work terribly well as we examine them over these many years. I wanted to provoke thought and encourage other ideas, other new ideas. We have a website, amoreperfectconstitution.com. I hope you'll go to it. It's easy to remember because it's the book title, with a .com, amoreperfectconstitution.com. As I always like to point out, it makes a wonderful holiday gift. Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa. You know, it's a one-stop shopping. People are impressed. They think you're intellectual. Everybody's tired of ties and purses and things like that. I think books make much better gifts. That's just a little personal comment. But the 23 ideas are designed to encourage others to come up with ideas, and we've got a space on this website for people to suggest their 24th or 25th or 28th. You know, you may have tons of ideas, and we just had an incredible reaction to this book. From right, left, and middle, everybody's afraid of the idea. It really shocks me that Americans should be so afraid to think. I mean, we're not talking about doing anything immediately. We're just talking about thinking about the process. There's nothing wrong with that. And I'm sorry, the Constitution, I hate to dispel a myth that may be prevalent among some of you, but the Constitution was not handed down to Moses on the Mount by God. See, this is not the equivalent of the Bible. It's become the secular Bible for lots of people, but it is not. And my justification for saying that is that the founders wanted us to revise the Constitution thoroughly with great frequency. And on the back of this book, we dispensed with the usual blurbs. And you know, you've seen those blurbs, and a lot of people are drawn in by them, and they really are fooled by them. And I've done it myself. I'm just as guilty as everybody else. You write the most famous people you know, who have the best known names, and you ask them for an endorsement. And the deal is this: they don't have to read the book. Often they don't even read the book jacket. Frequently an assistant writes the blurb. But you'll have the list of, you know, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, and if there's anybody serious left in the United States who endorses books and has an impact, you have them all down here. And the classic blurb says, "I laughed, I cried, it's better than Cats." That's what the back of the book says. And then people actually buy a book on the basis of blurbs not written by celebrities, but by an assistant who also hasn't read the book. So we decided instead to put some of you look shocked, like that's the first time you've ever heard that. You must have believed those blurbs, and I apologize for ruining this for some young people. But you have to grow up sometime. Thomas Jefferson: no society can make a perpetual constitution. I'm shortening it. The earth belongs always to the living generation. Every constitution naturally expires at the end of 19 years. If it be enforced longer, it is an act of force and not of right. This was Jefferson writing to Madison from Paris in 1789. Of course, Mr. Jefferson wasn't there for the Constitutional Convention. I've always felt that was one of the reasons why he opposed it and insisted on the Bill of Rights and other changes that he didn't get. But he wasn't there. He missed the action. He felt after the Declaration of Independence he'd done his part, and he did. But I don't think perhaps he realized in advance just how significant the Constitutional Convention would end up being, because he would have found a way to get back for it had he realized that. Anyway, Madison, who was the prime author of the Constitution, wrote back that it would give him singular pleasure to see this principle just articulated by Jefferson announced in the proceedings of the United States and kept always in their view as a salutary curb on the living generation from imposing unjust, unnecessary burdens on their successors. George Washington felt even more strongly about it and insisted that his generation was not, quote, more inspired, wiser, possessing of more virtue than those who will come after us. And so he wanted to see the Constitution revised with great regularity. In fact, he hoped that many of the ideas that he had rejected at the Constitutional Convention would come to be. So did Madison. You know, for those of you who may think that the Constitution was divinely inspired, and who knows, I, unlike a lot of people in American politics, I do not frequently talk to God, and he does not talk to me or she. I don't know. I'm off the wavelength there. You know, I don't get the personal messages that a lot of people who are running for president do. But I rather suspect that, you know, God was busy and had other things to do. I don't know that this was the top priority. And I can certainly tell you, with one example, this was happenstance to a certain degree. For example, James Madison argued strongly that members of the House of Representatives should have 3-year terms. And he insisted it was important to have longer terms so that the members of the House would not be constantly campaigning and attending to politics. Wasn't he perceptive? And Roger Sherman, a delegate from Connecticut who had entirely too much influence and won a lot of the battles at the Constitutional Convention, wanted 1-year terms for the House so that the representatives would constantly be close to the people. So they added up 3 and 1 and got 4 and divided by 2 and came up with the 2-year term. That's how we got a 2-year term. They split the difference. That doesn't sound like divine intervention to me. But everybody has his or her own idea about this. So anyway, I wanted to challenge the myths, get people thinking in new ways about the Constitution, asking as a society, can we build a better mousetrap the way our founders wanted us to do? Can we build a better mousetrap? The answer, of course, is yes. We have 300 million people. We have the best educated group of Americans in history. We have a completely different time and place than the founders had 220 years ago. They recognized that our circumstances would change and our needs in the Constitution would change. We haven't recognized it, partly out of fear. Fear of change, fear of the other side in this highly polarized age. My staff here from the Center for Politics can tell you about the tons of email that we've gotten from the right saying this is a terrible idea, mainly because the left-wingers, those Daily Kos crazies, will get in control of the convention and we'll have a socialist republic. And then tons of email from the left, including hundreds on the Daily Kos site saying, are you nuts? Those right-wing evangelical crazies will get in charge of this convention. And then we're going to have a religious republic. You see, each side fears the other. And they don't realize this is a generation or more away. They also don't have faith enough in the American people. I have more faith in that. And I have more faith in part because there are going to be so many barriers set up to approval of a new Constitution and any amendment to the Constitution that it's virtually impossible for anything from the left or right to get approved. Why is that? Because 34 states have to petition Congress for the Constitutional Convention. Remember, this is the second method in Article 5 of revising the Constitution. We're all used to the only way that's ever been used, the amendment process. But that has to go through Congress. And even in the beginning, the founders, having dealt with Congresses, knew that a Congress couldn't be trusted. That's something that they found validated as the years of the Republic wore on and their lives wore on. But the second method really bypasses Congress. It puts the power in the hands of the people in the states. That was actually the preferred method for the founders. They wanted the states to petition Congress. Congress had no choice once 34 states petitioned. They had to call a constitutional convention. And then what happens? Well, you have a constitutional convention. I've spent a chapter here suggesting how it might run and how it might be, yes, elected, not appointed, elected, one delegate per congressional district, and tons of details that I'm not going to bore you with at the moment, though you'll be engrossed and interested if you read it. And then what happens after the convention decides whatever it's going to decide? Well, then all the amendments have to be sent to the 50 states. And 38 states have to approve each and every word change. Now, how many solidly blue states are there? A minimum of 18. You could argue it's 20 or 21, but a minimum of 18 Democratic blue states. How many red states are there? An absolute minimum of 24, 25 red states. You could argue more than that. How many states does it take to stop a single change in the Constitution? 13. There is no change from a left-wing perspective or a right-wing perspective, a Democratic perspective or a Republican perspective that will ever be approved. Put your fears aside. Not going to happen. So what would be approved? Well, some structural changes that make sense, some nonpartisan consensus structural changes that make sense after all these years, like nonpartisan redistricting of the House of Representatives and both houses of the state legislatures. I find about 98.9% of the American public approves of that. Now, what's the other 1.9%? They're the members of Congress and state legislators, because they're the ones getting to form their districts and guarantee their re-elections in most cases. Not even all of them favor. It depends on whether their party's in power or not. And that's just one example. That's one of the 23. I can't give it all away in one presentation. You know, you wouldn't have any curiosity about getting the book. But that's an example of what we can do that is structural and nonpartisan. So I simply say to people, don't be afraid. Let's be a little bold, at least in our thinking. There's nothing wrong with thinking about it and asking good questions And this, my goal for this book was really twofold. One was to start a discussion and a debate about a subject that I believe the founders would have wanted us to have repeatedly over the years, and we failed them. They didn't fail us. We have failed them by being afraid to have the discussion. I want to start the discussion. I want to start the debate. And my second goal is more limited, but probably will be more successful. In our day and time, to get any attention for any subject or thought, you have to be provocative. And I have really stirred the pot in this book. I've got some proposals in here that, now let me put it this way. There isn't one person in this room that will agree with all 23. Not one. Now, you will be a very strange American if you don't agree with some of the 23. But there's nobody in here that's going to agree with all 23. I don't agree with all 23. I'm not telling you which ones. I still wake up and debate them in the middle of the night. But I wanted to start that debate and discussion, and you must be provocative. I hope rationally and reasonably and responsibly so. I've tried to be those things. But these are reasonable ideas to throw on the table to get people to start to think. And then, as I say, I will be thrilled if it just, because it is provocative, causes people to go to the Constitution and read it. To quote Chief Justice Roberts, no ideological suggestion to this quotation. See, I always have to say that because things are so polarized in America today. He recently said, quote, everyone talks about the Constitution, but nobody reads the Constitution. And he added, that includes judges and law professors. I enjoyed that. And I think, unfortunately, that's true. People read pieces of the Constitution. They'll refer to the Constitution. Almost nobody sits down and reads the whole Constitution. Yes, there's some archaic language in there. I want to get rid of some of it. And I'm suggesting where we can cut without problems, and there are other places we could cut that I didn't mention in the book. But people don't sit down and read it. One of the things that I hope to do over time is to apply this civics lesson, which we try to follow through on at the Center for Politics through our Youth Leadership Initiative program. I hope to apply the idea of reading the Declaration of Independence on July 4th, but adding the Constitution to it. Yes, there's a Constitution Day, September 17th. September 17th, no one even knows it's Constitution Day, and it's in the middle of a very busy season, a few weeks after the opening of all the schools, and so no one's ever going to take time on September 17th, I'm sorry, to sit down and read it, but we all have July 4th off, and it would be a very patriotic thing to do, to read both the Declaration of Independence, which is the philosophy of our system, and the Constitution, which is the philosophy in action of our system. Wouldn't that be a great thing if every American sat down on July 4th and read both? I know I'm dreaming, but we can increase the number, and certainly the young will do it. They're busy, but they also are educable. I really believe that. I've had 14,000 students. They're the hope of the world. I cannot get but so cynical. I'm sorry. Some of you who are older are very, very cynical because you don't teach. If you teach young people, you can't be but so cynical, at least the outstanding ones here at the University of Virginia. And I just can't let myself get cynical, and I won't, and I can't, and they will be the ones who not only will read the Constitution, but I believe will take up this charge, the charge of this book, and do something about improving the archaic parts of our Constitution. I'm going to stop there and take some questions and then relieve your suffering entirely and sign books for anybody that wants them, and then we'll go forward. Yes, sir.
You talked about teaching civics to your students. I remember when I was in school and we had our stone and chisel to write with, they taught civics to the elementary.
I was in school right after the last Ice Age, too. That's what we used.
But they taught civics.
Yes.
To elementary school students. Mm-hmm. They don't. Would you like to see a return to that so that by the time they get to you, they have at least a working knowledge of what the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence mean and how they're practiced?
I want to ask the members of my Center for Politics staff to stand. I want everyone in the center to stand. I know they don't want to, but they're going to anyway. This is about half the crew. They are going to change America, and they are changing it. And I want you to go to our website, centerforpolitics.org. You can get to the more perfect Constitution .com site from there, so it's one-stop shopping. But I want you to click on the Youth Leadership Initiative, and I want you to see what we're doing in tens of thousands of schools in all 50 states across America, plus the Defense Department schools around the world, improving the quality of civic education for free. For all of these teachers who sign up, we send all these materials to them, and that we get tremendous feedback. Our staff can tell you all about it. If you write me an email, I'll make sure that you get a personal answer with everything detailed, all the lesson plans and the bells and whistles and gimmicks that you have to use today to keep young people interested in the classroom. You'll be thrilled to see this stuff. And then on October 19th, next Friday, I hope you'll watch on C-SPAN if you can't attend, we're having the National Constitutional Convention. Yes, we're actually going one step beyond the book. We're having a constitutional convention in Washington at the Mellon Auditorium, appropriately enough, on Constitution Avenue. It's a beautiful auditorium. We're just so excited about our keynoters, Geraldine Ferraro, Bob Dole, Justice Alito, Donna Brazil, who ran the Nobel Prize winners campaign in 2000. Who won that election anyway? Think about it. That's a new question. Who won the 2000 election when you think about it? You've got poor old George W. Bush, one of the most unpopular presidents in American history, versus a guy who has made a minimum of $100 million since 2000 and has won an Emmy, the Academy Award, and the Nobel Peace Prize. Who won the 2000 election? So you can look at it in a different perspective. That's wonderful about how time changes one's perspective, isn't it? But the October convention, we have panels of outstanding scholars and journalists all day long debating. And some are going to say, these ideas are awful. And others are going to say, because I paid them, these ideas are terrific. And then some are going to say, you totally ignored idea 24, 25, 26, 27. And it's going to be a vigorous discussion all day long, which C-SPAN, thankfully, will share with the country over and over and over again. Thank God for C-SPAN. I'm looking forward to the holiday season, you know, because you'll be able to watch it much like A Christmas Story, 24 hours a day. They're terrific. Exactly. Yeah, that's right, with the bells. And certainly, you know, tape record it. Well, we'll probably give you a video if you want it. But please pay attention to that constitutional convention. And the audience is going to be mainly young people, not just from the University of Virginia, though we're delighted to have a big delegation coming up from here, but young people from all around the country who are interested in this idea. And we want to get them excited about it for the purposes that I suggested. So really, a lot of exciting things are happening in the world of civics education, and that's the purpose of my UVA Center for Politics. It's about civic participation and civic education. That's all we do. That's what we're interested in, because we know the country needs it. Way in the back. Yes, ma'am.
Just as a footnote to what he was questioning, our children go to Arrow County Schools.
They go to where?
The Arrow County Schools.
Yes. Yes.
He's taken American government, and they are starting. They are reading your textbook.
Excellent choice. Excellent choice. That, not this book. That'll be next year when they get that. But yeah. That, do they really? What? Yeah. I'm delighted to hear that. Well, we sent out. Now look, we're serious about this. We sent free copies to 1,000 high school teachers across America who are enrolled in our YLI program. We sent a free copy to every senator, to every member of the U.S. House of Representatives, to every governor, and to every senior state legislator in the country. We're serious, and we're getting tons of responses. And some things pretty much similar to what I suggested. Great ideas, terrible ideas. How can I hang you? You know, this kind of thing. But we're getting people to think about the Constitution and talk about it, and I'm just so excited. All right, yes.
Do you consider this fortuitous that this kind of dialogue begins in Charlottesville?
Well, of course, I'm a Charlottesvillian. Have been since the age of 18 when I matriculated to the University of Virginia. That somehow they accepted me. I made a terrible mistake, and many have regretted it for years and years and years. But I'm still here, you know, 37 years later, and absolutely. I mean, this is the home of Thomas Jefferson, more or less. We cheat. It wasn't really Charlottesville, but that's what we say, and everybody around the country and the world thinks Monticello is in Charlottesville, and we don't correct them. And the University of Virginia isn't. It's in Albert, at least the lawn and the rotunda, and it's in Albemarle County, which I've always found very odd, really. You know, we're surrounded by Charlottesville, but that one little piece of the university is in Albemarle County, and I had to change my voting place when I moved to the lawn. I was happy to do it, but it was irritating.
I guess to continue that thought, I once read an article by a woman named Donella Meadows that described the methods to approach the changing of paradigm, and the most important one was being at its base, at its beginning.
Yes. Well, I really appreciate what you've said. I hope that's true. That's my hope. You know, that's the idealistic half of me. It's been shrinking over the years, but I've still got it at half because I'm a teacher. You know, we'll not let the cynical side dominate. And remember, I work daily with the presidential candidates and their campaigns. It's a miracle that the cynical side is not 100% of me. And you have to work with them to know what I mean. It's why I'm voting for Thomas Jefferson next year. I don't even need to know who the nominees are. I'm writing in Jefferson. I know too much about all of them. Wouldn't have any of them if my life depended on it. Sorry. That's because of what I do. I'm not supposed to be invested in any particular candidate. So I hope you understand that and can appreciate the fact that, in my view, better a dead Jefferson than these live candidates. That's my slogan. I feel very strongly about that. Okay, there you go. We got a few Jefferson supporters here. Now, I saw, yes.
In a previous life, I spent 2 years working in the Clinton administration. So
you're too young to have a previous life.
So I've always been an Oregon Tree person. And I was intrigued by your proposal in there to do this notion of the confirmation election.
For the presidency. Why don't you, I'm thrilled that you actually read it. Instead of me explaining it, tell them what it is. Because this is a totally new idea. It may be totally wrong, but it's also totally new.
Well, the concept is if it's a six-year presidential term that someone's elected to, and at the end of year five, there's a confirmation election. And
tell them what a confirmation election is. They don't know what it is.
Yeah, only the incumbent is on the ballot, and it's either yes or no. And if the person gets a yes vote in a majority, they get to serve an additional 2 years, giving them the eight-year term that a president currently serves.
And they don't have to run for the additional two. They can pull a James K. Polk, which I think many would with a six-year term. But if they want the additional two, it's a judicial confirmation election applied to the presidency.
So my comment about it is, having been up there and worked in that world, and remembering what Gore did in 2004 when he chose not to run for re-election against Bush, he said at the time that...
That's interesting the way you phrase that.
Yeah, I mean... said it would have been too much of a focus on the rematch rather than ideas. And I think if you have this
exactly
confirmation election, you're not going to be talking about ideas enough. And, you know, as the phrase has been put, it means to be energy in the executive.
Yes.
And so I'm personally opposed to that one, and I just wanted to ask if you wanted to comment.
Sure. No, and look, I want people to say yay or nay on all of these proposals, and I want to have a vigorous debate, and that's great. And I'm not going to tell you whether that's one I'm totally sold on or not. But I will tell you this. I think the best thing about it, if I were to make it my strongest possible argument for it, leaving aside the arguments for a six-year term, which have been made forever. We're all familiar with the arguments, some good, some bad, for a six-year term. What I like about the confirmation election, which ambitious people will be attracted to, by definition, presidents are very ambitious. They're going to want that public affirmation. What will it do? Well, the key part of it is, once a president's in office, if he or she wants the confirmation election, he or she will get it and will not have to seek a renomination by the political party. Now, what will that mean for governance? It will mean that for those 6 years, maybe, just maybe, presidents will stop appealing to the hardcore party base, whether it's the right for the Republicans or the left for the Democrats, and they will focus on the 60 to 70% of Americans who really are centrists. They're center-left, they're center-right, they're dead-on center, but they'll try to serve that national interest as defined at least by a large majority of the public. I think that would be a great antidote to the extreme polarization that has developed in the United States, where literally everything is evaluated through the prism of whether Hillary Clinton's for it or George W. Bush is for it. Or you can pick other figures. That's not healthy. That's not good for us. We're one country. And we have to start thinking about that again. I'm praying that whoever wins in 2008, we have some red states that vote blue a lot of them, and a lot of blue states that vote red, that we mix it up, that we don't have the same map that we've had for two presidential elections, where only three states have changed sides. Three states in two elections, New Mexico, Iowa, and New Hampshire, and the average switch there was 2%. Three states changed sides. That is not healthy for the country. So that would be my argument for the 6-year confirmation election. Also, you know, having been through so many election cycles and covered these things hour by hour, not just day by day, presidential elections are always a referendum on the incumbent. It's thumbs up or thumbs down. If you're happy with the incumbent, you're going to vote for the incumbent. It really doesn't matter who the opposition party picks up. It can affect a percent or two, but not much. And if you're opposed to the incumbent, you're going to vote for the out party, even if you have doubts about that candidate. You know, Republicans forget that Ronald Reagan was not a giant in 1980. He was a 69-year-old guy that people feared had a little bit of Alzheimer's even then, and had no foreign policy experience. People wondered whether he was capable of being president, but they rejected Jimmy Carter. They wanted to get rid of Carter, so they took a big chance and voted for Reagan. Same thing happened in 1992. Does anybody really think that the American public trusted Bill Clinton? Of course they didn't. They learned enough during the 92 campaign to have a sense of what was coming. But they rejected George H.W. Bush. They wanted to get rid of him, so they took a chance. I mean, they did have Perot for a while until they found out he was nuts. So they only had one other alternative, and they voted for that alternative. So we often forget elections really are retrospective thumbs up or thumbs down on the incumbents. I tried to balance that by party. Okay, yes.
On the topic of presidential elections.
Can you speak up just a little bit? There's a lot of noise down here, and I can't hear.
On the topic of upcoming presidential elections and primaries and all that, I wonder, I guess it's a two-part question. Do you have anything in the book or anecdotally about either the current primary system where Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina get enormous power, or any about the fair vote where
sure. I'm in that group, by the way. Yeah, I'm in that group, though. I didn't do the ranking things. Look, that's another idea. That's another chapter. Yes, I changed the primary system. I published this in a couple of other places as the book was coming out. Virginia Quarterly Review had it, and USA Today had it. USA Today, you may not have understood it because they took what I thought was an incredibly short op-ed of 900 words and cut it to about 400 with a pie chart, typical USA Today. And I'm grateful they did it, but it's hard to follow. But anyway, here's what I'm proposing. And this system's insane. It's absolutely insane. And I'm just completely opposed to what we're about to have, which is a primary system driven by individual selfish state interests. The national interest is never considered. And the result is going to be the longest, most negative, day in and day out presidential general election campaign in American history. You looking forward to that? I've yet to meet anybody looking forward to it. Because the longer it goes on, the nastier it's going to get. That's the way politics runs today. I'm sorry to say. Yes, even a short campaign would get nasty, but it wouldn't have time to get as nasty as this one is going to get because of what we now have. I've got even worse news for you. Today, the Secretary of State of New Hampshire said the chances are now 50-50 that he's going to move the New Hampshire primary to December the 11th. And that means Iowa will be going December the 3rd. You like that? And then from December 11th on, we'll have, now I don't know absolutely it's going to happen. He said 50-50, which means there's a 50% chance it'll go the other way. But it means that over Christmas, Hanukkah, you're going to have constant negative advertising by the candidates desperately trying to survive, the ones who haven't won in Iowa and New Hampshire. And I can guarantee you that it's going to put people in such a bad mood that when they watch It's a Wonderful Life, they're going to be cheering for Jimmy Stewart to jump off the bridge. That's where we're all going to be. Is that good for the country? Of course it's not good for the country. So what's my alternative? I'm really proud of this. This one I do support strongly. Here's the idea. I call it the regional lottery plan. Now, for years, we've talked about having regional primaries where you divide the country into four, and it's their logical reasons, northeast, south, midwest, and west. All right, the regions kind of define themselves. So you've got four regions. Now, What can you do with those four regions? Well, the first thing you could immediately do is truncate the campaign. How many Americans have said, God, I wish we could shorten these campaigns? Look at parliamentary systems. Look at Great Britain. They have a full election with people really paying attention for 4 weeks, approximately. Sometimes it's 3.5, sometimes it's 5, but it's basically a 4-week election. And, you know, they do okay. They've done all right, all things considered. Yes, it's a different system, a parliamentary system. But surely we don't need 2.5 or 3 years to run a presidential election, which is what we've got now. Why do we have it? Because everyone knows the campaign will begin in Iowa and New Hampshire, which means that your candidates, all of them, anybody with ambition, 2.5, 3 years in advance, will start moving into Iowa, New Hampshire. I mean the dog and the cat and the kids and the spouse and a bunch of staffers and, of course, the millions of dollars it takes to run these campaigns day after day after day after day. That's what happens. Well, you have 4 regional primaries. You can start them as late as April, even the end of April. End of April, end of May, end of June, end of July, both conventions in August, just as we're going to have both conventions in August in 2008. It can be done. That shortens the campaign dramatically. But you say, oh, wait a minute, they'll just go in those 2.5, 3 years in advance. Well, that's where the lottery comes in. Now, I didn't happen to vote for the lottery back when it was up in Virginia because of what I felt were unfair consequences and who plays the lottery and so on and so forth. Well, I'm a convert now, at least to this form of lottery. On January 1st of the election year, meaning if this system were in effect, January 1st, 2008, in the middle of the Rose Bowl, we would have a lottery, and it would be a 2-part lottery. In one fish bowl, you would have 4 ping pong balls, with each ping pong ball having the name of a region on it. And the chairperson of the Federal Election Commission is going to pick them out one at a time. And that's the order of the regions. No one will know where the election begins until January 1st. Will the candidates and the staffs get on planes on January 1st? Yep, they'll go to whichever is the first region. That's fine, though. We've already shortened the campaign considerably. The second part of the lottery, it's a second bowl. Because I do believe it's important to have 2 or 3 small states begin the process. They do act as presidential selection committees. They take it seriously. And the population small enough, voting population small enough, so that you can have almost the candidates interviewed. I mean, I have literally met Iowans and New Hampshireites who won't even consider voting for somebody until he or she's been in their home 3 or 4 times. Won't even consider it. There's something to be said for that. They really get to know them. They get to know the pluses and the minuses. They ask a lot of really nosy questions. Any of you who have been to Iowa during the caucus process, you know what I'm talking about. They won't hold back. And they don't take any guff off the candidates either. I really enjoy that. Like Hillary Clinton not refusing to take questions. It's cost her 5 points in Iowa. Those 4 events where she refused to take questions. They are furious across the board. Doesn't matter who they're for. They just got mad that she wouldn't take questions. So that's a good thing. But hey, Iowa and New Hampshire, and this is a shot to the Hawkeye and Granite staters, they are not in the Constitution. They think they are. They think they have the constitutional right to go first. Not mentioned. We don't have a politics article because the founders were opposed to mass democracy and they were opposed to factions, political parties. They changed their minds about both, but the Constitution had long been written. Most other constitutions have a politics article around the world with some governing structure to help their system work. We don't have any. That's why all the states are acting individually. Back to the second bowl. I get excited about this. Back to the second bowl. What's in that bowl? 20 ping pong balls. Because there are 20 states, not just Iowa, New Hampshire, 20 states with 4 electoral votes or fewer. And they'll be in the bowl, and 2 or 3 of them will be picked out. And a couple of weeks before the main contest, beginning in April, maybe they'll be early April, they'll start the process. So that's where the candidates and the staffs will be jetting on January 1st. Fine. Let them do it. But it'll take them a while to build the structures and do all the other things. I'm very excited about the regional lottery plan. And I'd say of all the proposals, that's already gotten the most support. I've had a lot of elected officials say, gee, that makes sense. I never thought of having a lottery. Because this regional proposal's been out there for years, but it doesn't change anything. because they'll just go in 3 years in advance to the first region. Everybody knows where the first region will be because they'll simply have them rotating every 4 years. So there's a new idea that's never been proposed before. It doesn't make it good, but at least it's new. Yes?
A few years back, the American Association for Advancement of Science looked at the election process and tried to determine the fairest means of voters expressing their preference. And that's what they came up with, a preference system.
Yes.
Now, it is not simple and straightforward. It takes all kinds of checks and balances to make it work properly.
Yes.
But the scientific community basically said, properly run, preference voting,
yes,
express the true will of the people.
Yes, that's the gentleman back here asked about Fair Vote. I actually belong to this group, fairvote.org, and I'm on their circulation list and participate in their deliberations and so on. Yes, that preference voting is possible and doable. A number of major cities have preference voting already. It works reasonably well, although it took a tremendous amount of civic education in very small communities or concentrated communities to get the idea across. And even on election day, for years after they started it, there was tremendous confusion about, and this is where you vote for a candidate, but you also state your second preference and your third preference and your fourth preference so that there's automatic runoffs. Now, there's something to be said, I'm kind of for it, but you can also argue against it because the runoff dynamic in a real runoff is different than the runoff dynamic as you're just listing preferences, 1, 2, 3, 4. But let's leave that aside. Sir, I would say this to you. Most of the changes I have in here are controversial enough, but I've tried to keep the proposals relatively simple. Problem with that is it isn't simple, and people don't grasp it. And so I want to wait until the Youth Leadership Initiative is in every school in America and has trained every young person for, say, 30 years. And then I'll be willing to consider, ordinal preference voting. And not until. Yes, sir.
As I understand it, the Bill of Rights is with the off-limits to
your proposal. Bill of Rights, off-limits.
Poison pill.
Poison pill, because of the social issues. Yes, sir. I think that probably the key amendments of the Constitution would be added to the call to convention that Congress would issue after receiving the petitions from the 34 states. Somebody didn't like that proposal. See, I told you this was controversial. But I think absolutely, I could have gone beyond that. I could have said, I could have gone through the amendments and listed the ones. And I think that will be done by Congress if there is such a constitutional convention. Sir, I missed what you said. I'm sorry.
A lot of the federal constitution applies to state law through the 14th Amendment.
Yes, correct. I think that's very probable. And I think there'll be other amendments that would be put off limits, but there'll be many amendments that won't be. The ones affecting the Electoral College. I've got a chapter on that with a lot. Now, I keep the Electoral College, which may shock a lot of you, because you would think, oh, well, surely he'll go to popular vote. Well, no, I don't, because I actually like the idea of the Electoral College as a concept because it undergirds federalism. But the real reason why I like it is because it isolates recounts. Now, I've just got one question for you. Would you have wanted what happened in Florida in 2000 to have gone national in a close election? Of course not, because we never would have gotten a president. We would have had acting president Dennis Hastert probably for 4 years. The Speaker of the House. We never, because you would have had 50 states and 300,000 precincts being recounted. It would have gone on forever. It's a full employment act for the lawyers. No offense to the lawyers in the room. I want you to be well fed, but not that well fed. It's bad for your health. So I keep it, but I changed the Electoral College considerably, making it more representative of the population, eliminating, well, electors get to stay as people, but only as honorary positions. So that you eliminate faithless electors. It only would have taken two faithless electors in 2000 to switch the election results. Nobody knows these people. You really think that they're all incorruptible? I mean, just think New Jersey, Louisiana, Illinois. I mean, those three states alone, you probably got 30 that are corruptible. I'm surprised it didn't happen. in 2000. So I want to make the electoral votes cast automatically to eliminate the possibility of the corruption of individual electors in close elections and so on. But I'm getting into too much detail here and boring you. I'm going to take a couple more questions, cease and desist, sign books for those of you who've been enticed, and we'll go from there. Yes, sir.
Does any of your proposals address the party system, which seems to have really been what's done the original Constitution dirty, and perhaps McCain-Feingold being the worst nail in the coffin, putting all of the power in the party offices, and you mentioned faceless electors, faceless party leadership, Howard Dean, who we really don't know who they are, and they make all the decisions.
Yeah, I don't govern parties from the Constitution, but five of these proposals directly affect how parties run. And they give a governing structure. I guess since Al Gore got that prize today, I can say that there gives a controlling legal authority. Remember that phrase from a controversy in Gore's time? A controlling legal authority to the parties and makes them more responsive to the national interests rather than individual state and local interests. I said I supported federalism, but there have to be exceptions in order to make the system work well. I'll be interested to see what you think of that, those five proposals, and there's one whole chapter called, you know, the politics article, which is centered on parties. Yes?
Is there a class in the spring that will be using this as its textbook?
Well, there certainly will be a 101 class, and it will be suggested. You can't order students to do anything, and we'll have lots of free copies in the library for those who are opposed philosophically to, and they'll use that as an excuse. They're philosophically opposed to this proposal or that, and therefore cannot purchase a copy. So we'll have copies available for them in the library. Thank you for asking. I take one more question, then we'll go to book signing. Anybody got a last question? You're ready to go. You're ready to go, and I hope come up and have a book signed. And I appreciate very much your showing up. 5:30 on a Friday. Come on up if you want a book signed. Thank you.